Welcome to the Growing Rural Podcast, where we focus on all things rural in South Carolina. We will discuss topics on healthcare, economy, education, and the unique culture that is our rural state. This podcast is supported by the South Carolina Center for Rural and Primary Healthcare. Please join us for today's topic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Growing Rural Podcast. Today, we'll be discussing social determinants of health and rural disparities research. Our guest today is Dr. Jan Probst, Distinguished Professor Emerita with the University of South Carolina. Let's begin. Dr. Probst, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this field.
Okay, well, as you mentioned, my name is Jan Probst. I got my doctorate here at the University of South Carolina way back in the Wayback Machine in 1990. And when I began to figure out what I would study for my doctoral research, that we were going through an epidemic of rural hospital closures. So I said, aha, that's something I should examine. And to put a spin on it, I said, I'm going to examine the economic consequences of rural hospital closure. And basically, that started me on a career that has gone since then, pretty much, looking at rural problems, examining more about rural hospital closures, and then wandering along into the topic of disparities experienced by rural minority populations, both here in South Carolina and elsewhere, because I found that that was a topic that people were not looking at. Everyone assumed that if you knew what the situation was for an African American in downtown Manhattan, you knew what it was in Albany, Georgia, which is, we would say as rural experts, it's clearly not the case, but until you started running the numbers, people didn't know it wasn't the case.
And why do you think that is? Why wasn't that cross-section being examined?
I would say there's two reasons. One is that there is a real urban focus in our population, 80% of which lives in urban areas, and 80% of the population in those urban areas is interested in urban issues. And they tend to study what's going on in urban areas, and they're more conscious of what's going on in urban areas. So that has led to an overall neglect of rural research until quite recently. The neglect of rural minority populations was sort of due to stereotypes. If you were a rural minority, the stereotype was that you were an Hispanic person who's picking vegetables somewhere. There had been such a great migration of, for example, African Americans to urban areas that urban had become almost synonymous with Black living in the inner city. People had neglected the fact that here in the South, a substantial portion of the rural population is still African Americans who have managed to hang on and not be driven out during that period when people were being pushed north. So we have significant minority populations that people living in those little bits on the coast don't think about, which we needed to, I thought, bring out. And that was sort of a mission that we undertook beginning in 2000.
So how has the field of rural minority research change since you've started this work?
I would say it's expanded, which is like wonderful. We don't exist to do just what we do. We exist to inspire other people to do the research and the interventions that will help people. For example, when we put our first bid in 2000, somebody had done a literature review, and in the preceding 20 years, there had only been 73 papers dealing with rural African-American populations, you know, maybe two in a squinch a year. And since then, we've had new research centers open with focuses on minority populations. We have great research coming out of a number of our universities now. I'm not going to claim that we did it. We were part of a wave of people discovering that there are populations that need investigation. And of course, in the last 4 years, there's been an uptick in rural research generally, as people start to realize how all rural populations have fallen behind.
Have there been any demographic shifts in rural over the past 20 or so years that you've been aware of?
Over the past 20 years in rural, I think the biggest thing that people would notice is the growth in the Hispanic population in places where Hispanics did not traditionally live. We have to point out that in places like Texas, New Mexico, and California, there were persons of Hispanic descent living before those were states because they used to not be part of the U.S. But what has happened more recently is Hispanic populations have started to look for work in places like Nebraska South Carolina, drawn by specific industries, construction, poultry, and other forms of meat processing. That has been a big change nationally. That would be the one that I think has been most noticed.
So are there any emerging issues in the area of rural health research that you think are important for us to know about?
I think there is emerging attention to rural in general, and I, in a way, attribute part of it to the fact that we now have much better data resources than we had. When I started this stuff in 1990, you could not go to a website and find out every county's social determinants of health, you know, things like poverty, education, health. Now we have multiple places that track all that, which has made it easier for us to suddenly realize that we have major emerging issues. We have issues in terms of health of the population, as people are suddenly realizing that rural people die at earlier ages. They have shorter lifespans, higher mortality rates than people living in urban areas. And when you look at the data, that mortality crisis, as I will label it, really did not used to exist. In the 1960s through the 70s and into the 80s, rural and urban death rates are tracking each other nicely. Then somewhere in the 80s and again in the 90s, it begins to pull off, whereas urban populations continue to improve in health status and rural populations increasingly fall behind. I think if you wish to call it a crisis, finding out why rural people are dying continues to be a crisis. And I've just finished working on a study looking at death rates among rural children and the fact that rural children's death rates continue to be higher than urban children's death rates. It's just heartbreaking to me as a mother and by now a grandmother. That's just horrible. Okay, so that's one. We have a crisis of increasing rural mortality. That's the statistic, can't lisp this bad, that's a statistic you can't argue with. You're either dead or alive. When you start looking at why rural mortality might be greater, you start seeing that other crisis, which is the loss of rural institutions. And we have two types of rural institutional loss that are particularly cogent. One is the loss of people who provide maternity care in rural areas. The physicians, either family practice or are obstetrics, who deliver babies leave, and they leave because hospitals stop offering obstetric services. It's a loss leader. It's got a high malpractice overhead, and people feel that they don't need it, that the principal payer for all maternity services is Medicaid, which is a low-quality payer, if you will. The second part of that crisis is the loss of hospitals themselves, because when you lose a hospital, you lose any physicians who might have practiced in that area, then you start losing the pharmacists, you start having problems with your long-term care facility. All sorts of things concatenate after the death of a hospital.
So you mentioned the higher mortality rate among rural children. What are some of the drivers of that?
Thank you. I really do worry about this, and I do have an article with some co-authors that will be coming out shortly looking at this issue in detail. But to give you the 5-second summary, the two biggest drivers of death that are clearly avoidable, we can't do much to avoid congenital problems which affect urban and rural children. But one of the things that affects rural children more intensely is basically all kinds of injury. And I'm going to crack those into two bits. There's motor vehicle crashes, for which the death rate in rural areas is nearly twice that in urban areas. And a lot of it, it's not just that rural people are bad drivers or less likely to wear their seatbelts. A lot of it is that the accidents take place at higher speed, and the emergency response is going to be at least twice what it's going to be in an urban area. So for the children who are seriously injured, that golden window evaporates before they are brought to an appropriate level of care.
So which is related to access to facilities, correct?
Correct.
Emergency departments,
correct,
or EMS,
correct,
or the like.
It's related to that. Things that we could do to reduce the motor vehicle traffic death include strict enforcement of alcohol laws, because the parents can be driving drunk, sad to say. There are a certain number of fatalities that occur because of that. And also making seatbelt use a primary offense, because the data show that when failure to have your seatbelt buckled is something they can stop you for, as opposed to something that only can be looked at later, it affects not just adult seatbelt use, which is important, but teen seatbelt use, because teens being brave and I don't need a seatbelt is a problem, but they will be The data show that when you have primary enforcement laws, teens are more likely to use their seatbelts. If I were to look at older children and adolescents, in my research looking at kids who are 10 to 19, the suicide rate for rural children is about twice that of urban children.
Do we have any idea why that might be?
We have many ideas. We do know that in some cases it's because they are in economically and socially depressed situations. There are fewer resources available to them. Their schools are less likely to offer counseling services.
Like mental health counseling.
Exactly.
Okay.
There is a government-funded program through the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration called the Garrett Lee Smith, I believe it is. I would have to double check. Excuse me. There is a program funded by SAMHSA that gives grants to states and tribal organizations to provide counseling services and gatekeeper training. Gatekeeper training is important. Having a teacher, for example, or a school custodian, or anyone who might encounter the young person know when this person is exhibiting danger signs of depression.
So identifying at-risk youth and
adolescents. And getting them into treatment. The problem is, of course, that there are, again, there are fewer resources. If we could get a way to get more mental health resources with less stigma into rural schools, that would help. The other one, a little bit more controversial, but I think it's at the least possible level of controversy of this issue, is access to firearms. Mm-hmm. There are things called child access protection laws, which say that if you have a gun in the house and you have a child in the house, the gun must be safely secured. And there are things like you could have a gun cabinet, you could have trigger locks.
Right.
There are 27 states that have such laws. Where such laws are in effect, the overall firearm death rate among youth and adolescents is lower. This applies to everyone, but since rural children are more at risk because rural homes are more likely to have guns, because I grew up in a rural area, that gun is a harvesting equipment for you to get your meat for the winter.
Right.
But so if you had those safely stored, that delays, if you will, the suicidal impulse. You can't just pull and shoot. You got to get the key. You got to unlock it. Right. That those laws have been shown to reduce child deaths.
Dr. Probst, you mentioned earlier social determinants of health. I believe you just came out with a series of reports around social determinants of health among minority populations in rural America. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, this social determinants is a growing area as well. People are starting to realize that your health isn't just you and what you do. It's what you bring to the table in terms of your education and your income and your resources and what's around you at that table. And
such as, give some examples.
Such as, how far is it to healthy food? How far is it to a place where you can exercise safely? How safe do you feel in the streets at night? Because obviously these social determinants of health are active in both rural and urban areas. In rural areas, some of the things that we have found is that the counties that are inhabited by our minority populations, which is African Americans in the South, Hispanic populations are the dominant minority in the Southwest, and you have Native Americans basically scattered in both the West and Mountain West. In the areas where you have high concentrations of minority populations, you also tend to have higher concentrations of poverty, more people who lack health insurance, poorer access to healthy foods. There is a whole network of things that address how easy it is or how hard it is for you to keep yourself and your family healthy.
And these differences are exacerbated by being in rural, right?
Correct. We really did focus on what are the problems in rural America. Focusing a little bit on kids, since that's my area of current interest, some things are good in rural. People are more likely to report that they have a safe environment, that they have people around whom they could ask for help if they needed help with their taking care of their child. They are more likely to feel, I say, comfortable in their neighborhood.
Kind of like a social network, cohesiveness type idea.
Yeah. The problem is, of course, that that is a cohesive network of people who don't have access to things at a level up that might help them stay healthy.
Right.
You perhaps aren't shopping at the best grocery stores. It is too far away. You end up eating a lot of processed foods because you don't have access to the high quality, low cost foods that might be better for you.
Right. So what are some of the key takeaways from your reports that you think are important?
I would say where we are, our dominant minority population is African American. If we were in Appalachia, we'd be having this same conversation about white people. Social determinants of health are not necessarily a function of, you know, what you look like, but what has been available to you. We talk about them as upstream because, you know, your life sort of flows by in a stream, and where the stream is today is affected by where the stream was before. And if we could fix the befores, we can fix somebody else's tomorrow.
So some of those structural issues that affect how you live and your environment and all those issues, right?
And if I could fix one of them to start with, I would fix schools. Because schools are a way that we can reach children in so many ways. We can engage them at the obvious level through their school nurses, through the idea I mentioned before about gatekeepers who can look for the signs of a youth in trouble and direct them for appropriate counseling and even provide counseling through the schools. But more than that, having a high quality education that prepares you either for college or the workforce. I mean, not everybody is necessarily going to go to college, and the world needs people who can work with their hands. But both of these occupations in this day and age require great schools. And unfortunately, if you look at the corridor of shame, the place in South Carolina, the poor counties along the I-95 corridor, to use an example from us, those are the places that have the worst schools, the lowest spending, the students who have to make do with, I don't know, I'm trying to think of something like DOS, a really old computer as opposed to a nice spiffy new Surface.
If they have a computer at all.
If they have a computer at all. One of the issues that I looked at getting prepared to talk about social determinants of health is broadband. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily think about it, but broadband disappears when you go into parts of South Carolina or parts of rural America, anywhere. But you need it for your schoolwork these days. Mm-hmm. Most of the schools will put their students' assignments on some form of internet-served bulletin boardy type thing. You have kids who can't do their homework at home because they can't access the resources they need, even if they had a home computer. They may have dial-up. Dear sweet Lord, dial-up. Rural America has been disproportionately underserved. There is evidence showing that reduces your availability of telemedicine and telehealth at the way downstream end, but I want to go upstream. I want to make everything that kids need to get a great education and a great job available in their local community, which is going to take state legislatures being willing to fund rural schools.
Following up on the broadband discussion, the American Medical Informatics Association actually has encouraged including broadband access as a social determinant of health.
That's a great idea.
So what do you think that would accomplish?
It would allow us to focus more clearly on where the short spots are. If you'll remember earlier in our discussion, I suggested that the attention to rural health has been made possible in part by the fact that there are all these county maps that let people, through programs such as the Robert Wood Johnson County Rankings, through the U.S. Department of Agriculture and their Food Environment Atlas, these maps let a county go and say, wait a minute, I, in this little rural county in Kansas, am doing way poorly than somebody in metro Kansas. I can do something about it. If we had broadband defined in some way that let local leadership see where they were falling behind, there would be more incentive to get it fixed.
So I've actually gone to private companies' websites to check on internet availability at specific addresses within areas that the FCC says have broadband access. And the most they have is DSL. And typically this is because they just don't have the infrastructure there to do that. Is this common across rural America that you know of, or?
To the best of my understanding, it is. One of the former presidents of the National Rural Health Association used to share a slide with a little, it's one of those signs that you see by the road that says, for in emergency, dial star HP for highway patrol, right. But there is no cell service in that area. Right. And there is no cell service, I certainly know here, in lots of places in South Carolina, right. Having driven around the state on various expeditions. We do need good mapping, but we need to tie the map of what the service is to the map of who can use it, because none of these services come free.
Right.
And, you know, are they available at a price that the ordinary household in that community can afford? Right. And households with children, unfortunately, tend to be at the lower end of the economic spectrum because you have children earlier in your life before you've really started working your way up in your job. And a lot of people have fairly modest jobs when they still have children.
So your reports are national data, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So what can you tell us about social determinants and rural South Carolina specific to our state?
Okay, thank you. That's a great question because, you know, this is our home state and I've driven around and seen most of it. Our rural areas in South Carolina are disproportionately affected by obesity, by diabetes, by persons being positive for HIV. They come out favorably with regard to lower rates of overdose. Perhaps to our benefit, we haven't been struck in that area quite as badly as other states yet. But the social determinants are what lead us to what's already bad and may cause further badness, if you will. Our rural counties, particularly the ones down sort of in the PD area that are our historically black counties, are also historically poverty counties. There is a phrase that the U.S. Department of Agriculture uses called persistent poverty counties, which means that a large proportion of the population, like 20%, has been living under the poverty level for at least the last three censuses or a period of 30 years. And many of our counties in that area light up for being persistent poverty counties. And there's a web of things that go with persistent poverty. With persistent poverty, you have poor school systems because you don't have the tax base feeding in to get the nice things that we have here in the Columbia area. So I'll go from poverty, which is going to affect education, which is going to affect your ability to keep and maintain providers in the area. Right. Now, all of those counties are health professional shortage areas, meaning that they have fewer doctors than various algorithms developed by the health experts at the federal government think an area should have, and they don't have them because it's really too difficult to pay them. There are federally qualified health centers that help by trying to recruit physicians in and taking patients on a sliding scale, and physicians can get loan reimbursement when they work in those settings. But one of the problems is that when the loan reimbursement is completely paid off, the physician will tend to move, or the family practitioner will tend to move
to a higher paying job somewhere else.
Exactly.
Right.
So we really need to sort of start lifting up those communities from the bottom. So, and how do we do that? Economic development, perhaps, that will, if we can figure out ways to get more jobs to these communities. Right. This is a one-off, but I just read this morning of a rural community in Appalachia that is attempting to develop a high-end luthier, a maker of guitars, mandolins, in the community, taking people who maybe have skills in woodworking and saying, this is something that we can do that will bring high-quality jobs to our community. I thought, well, you can't have one of those in every county.
Right.
But there are probably opportunities.
For the right county, that would work.
Yeah. There are probably opportunities like this that we need to find if we can get our rural county development people to start looking a little bit more creatively at what people are doing around the country, mm-hmm. and also looking for some of our barriers. And here I'm going to speak, for example, of a really trivial barrier, but one that upsets one of my friends enormously, mm-hmm. which is that if you are, for example, living in low-income housing in South Carolina, and say you're a single mom, you got two kids, you're 25, you decide, I've got to better myself, I'm going to go back to community college, you can't do that because you cannot be a student and be in low-income housing. And you can see how the intent was to make sure that all the well-paid, you know, the students at the University of South Carolina, all thousands and thousands of them, are not pushing low-income people out of help that they need. Right. But at the same time, we have to make sure that when we help people, we aren't interfering with their ability to help themselves.
Or disincentivizing. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the more pressing issues for rural South Carolina right now?
Okay, I think one of our biggest problems is keeping a healthcare presence, keeping our hospitals alive in rural where we can. In Kingstree, for example, the flood of 2015 took out the hospital, and it basically was not able to come back. Now, maybe we don't need a hospital in every rural community, but we need something. And I think we need to make sure that to the extent we can, we keep rural hospitals viable. We keep them from becoming acquisition targets from urban hospitals, which then close them down to ensure that all the business comes to the main hospital, which is its principal source of revenue and that the outlying ones are not discarded. Those are short-term things. I think we need to creatively think about how we're recruiting practitioners to rural areas. The State Office of Rural Health does a great job with this. South Carolina AHEC does a great job with this. Any support we can give or creative ideas we can come up with for getting our doctors, our physician assistants, our advanced nurse practitioners into rural communities would be wonderful.
Right. And here at the Center for Rural and Primary Healthcare, we do have a program to get healthcare providers of all types into rural areas. So check our website for those details. We've talked about a lot of negative stuff with rural, dual disparities, digital divides. Tell me some good things about rural South Carolina that's going on right now.
Well, let's see. I'll go with a few. And I'm going to start at Lake City, where Morris Brown, one of our family practice physicians who actually came to South Carolina 25 years ago on one of those National Health Service Corps payback your loan deals. Actually, he was recruited by a mayor who said, you won't make a lot of money here, but you'll make a difference. Dr. Brown has stayed in that community for 25 years, and just this year was recognized nationally as a by the National Organization of State Offices of Rural Health as a star, a star in rural. And Lake City, through its art fields. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with, they have a big it focuses on the visual arts, like Charleston has Piccolo Spoleto. Art Fields focuses on, I believe, visual arts. They bring people to the community and let people see some of the historic buildings there and just be in the atmosphere. As someone who grew up in a rural area, I would say that all of rural South Carolina has that green space that we think mm-hmm. people need to connect with to be creative, that children need to let their minds run loose. Mm-hmm. I don't think people appreciate it when they're just working through the day to day, but green is really good when you can go have children go out of doors safely, run around.
Right. And I think Lake City, don't they have a pretty robust farmers market, local farming community as well?
Yes. And I do notice that the South Carolina Department of Agriculture supports Ag and Art, where they highlight farms that you can visit. Like they, I would recommend you get somebody to talk about that other than me, since my knowledge is based just on seeing their adverts.
Right.
But yeah, I think so. We do have people who are trying to focus on the positive in rural.
So I've heard a lot of different definitions of rural. My favorite one, I don't know if I can say on the air, but basically if you can go outside and use the bathroom without being seen, you're in a rural area.
Only guys would do that.
Possibly, but I'm not sure that's completely true. What is your favorite definition of rural? If you had to explain to someone who is completely unfamiliar with what rural actually is, how would you describe it to them?
Dr. Bennett has just asked a scientist who always works in quantitative definitions to come up with something off the top of my head that does not involve numbers.
That's right.
This is very challenging. Hence my rural is where you feel you can breathe. I have been to New York City. It creeps me out. There are too many people and they're too close to me.
Right.
I like being in a rural area. I currently live in an area that was rural 25 years ago, but it is being creeping suburbed on.
It is no longer rural.
Correct. Not as rural as I want, but I can look outside and the people up the street have horses. There are trees outside my window. My husband can fish in a lake if he wants.
Dr. Probst, thank you for your time. This has been extremely informative. Where can our listeners find out more about you and your work and those that you work with?
Okay, I'm going to give you two sites. I'm going to tell you to ask people to look up the Rural Health Information Hub. It is a source of information for people who live in rural areas. They serve nationally. They have lots of resources on their website, and they have lots of maps, and they have people who will answer questions if you email them. Again, that's the Rural Health Information Hub, and it's at the University of North Dakota. The Rural Health Information Hub, like the research that I have done on rural, is funded by the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy, and they're located within the big U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And if you go to that Federal Office of Rural Health Policy, they list all of their grant programs. They have links to organizations that they work with. I think both of those are great resources for finding out more about your own community, about what people are doing in other communities, and about sources of funding.
That's great. We'll put links to these websites in our show notes, as well as links to get to the reports we discussed that she just released. And thank again for your time. That's all for today. Stay tuned for future episodes that are coming out soon.
Thanks for listening to the Growing Rural Podcast. If you found the content valuable, please leave a rating on iTunes or Spotify so others can find us. For more information, please visit our website at sc.edu/ruralhealthcare or follow us on Twitter at sc_CRPH. This was recorded at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine in Columbia. It is edited and produced by Sean Riffle. Y'all take care.